Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580, hour number two. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for the show, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, and Henry Frain, is at the controls this morning. Obesity has become a serious problem for many American children. Now, often it is the parents who end up getting the blame if their kids are dangerously or unhealthily overweight. But also, some experts say, well, you know, kids spend an awful lot of their time in school, and they argue that, in fact, that schools aren't doing enough to teach children about good nutrition and also when food is offered in schools to offer high-quality food. And this morning, in this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking with Marlene Schwartz. She is the Deputy Director for the Rudd Center for Food Policy and Obesity at Yale University. And in her research, she looks at how the home, how communities, how schools all shape the eating attitudes and behaviors of children. And we'll be talking about a number of things with her, including food policies in school settings. We'll try to talk about the problem of weight disorders that we have in this country, particularly for young people. Talk about how food is marketed at children and how, as a society, we should respond to all of these things. I also want to mention that she will be here in Champaign-Urbana on the campus of the University of Illinois next week to give the keynote address at a conference that is being hosted by the Family Resiliency Center and the Pampered Chef programs here on the campus. They're part of the Department of Human and Community Development. This is the Illinois Summit on Early Childhood and Healthy Beginnings. You do have to register, but people, if you're interested in this, the easiest thing to do would be to go to the Family Resiliency Center website, and you can get more information. They'd also like to mention that, like me to mention, that the fall lecture, the Pampered Chef Family Resiliency Program fall lecture, will be presented next week on Thursday. And the speaker will be the president of the University of Illinois, Joe White, talking about brilliant futures for America's children. And then the next day, on Friday, that's when the talk takes place by, I hope I have this right. Anyway, the conference begins the next day. And that's the thing at which our guest will be the speaker. And it's taking place at the Alice Campbell Alumni Center on the U of I campus. So we'll try and run down the information for you again a little bit later. Also, we'd want to invite people here who are listening to call in questions, comments. Please do keep them brief so we could keep moving and keep on the topic. But your questions, comments are welcome. 333-9455. That's the number here in Champaign-Urbana. We also have a toll-free line that is good to anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So 333-9455. And toll-free 800-222-9455. And speaking with us from Yale, Dr. Marlene Schwartz. Dr. Schwartz, hello.
Hello.
Thanks very much for talking with us.
I'm happy to be here.
Just to start here, this is something that's gotten a lot of attention in the media, but maybe we should again reinforce the point that childhood obesity has become a real problem. It seems to be getting worse. And it's not just an American problem, is it?
No, it's actually a global problem that other countries, particularly industrialized countries, are seeing increases in obesity similar to the ones we have here in the United States. And one of the things that's most concerning about it isn't just the high rate of obesity, but how quickly this epidemic has taken place, that rates of childhood obesity are twice as high now as they were in the 70s and three times as high for adolescents.
We should talk about some of the reasons, and I think that it is complicated, and I think we try to make it simpler than it actually is. We can talk about some of these things in detail, but if I just ask a question like, well, why has this become such a problem, and why does it seem to have come on fairly quickly, at least it's something that I think we've really only been talking about within the last few years.
Well, I think that one of the things that's really changed is our overall food environment. And one of the ways that we've been thinking about this is that if you look at the factors that contribute to what you decide to eat, people tend to pick things that are inexpensive, are easily available, are heavily marketed and taste good. And if you were to create a graph and you put all the healthy foods on that graph and looked at them on each of those dimensions, what you would find is that unhealthy foods tend to be cheaper. They tend to taste better because they're high in sugar, fat, and salt. They tend to be very accessible. They're in vending machines, corner stores, drug stores, pretty much anywhere you go. And so people really find that it's much easier to eat unhealthy foods than to eat healthy foods.
Hmm. If we shift our focus here a little bit to the school setting, because I know that's something that you've done a lot of work on and you'll be talking about when you're here to take place in this conference. Let's just start with asking this question. So if you look at what's offered to children, and I'm particularly here, I'm thinking of not so much what might be in vending machines or what might be there for choice. If we move through the lunch line, and we looked at what's being offered, how are we doing in terms of simply offering good food, having it there?
Well, it's highly variable depending on what district you're in. But basically, there are two types of food that are available in the cafeteria. There's the official school lunch, which is, if you're part of the National School Lunch Program, is actually regulated by federal law and is required to contain a fruit, a vegetable, a protein, a starch, and milk. So that official school lunch is not – I mean, it may not be the highest quality food, but at least there's an array of different foods. Then, in addition to that, most cafeterias also offer a la carte foods, which are not part of the school lunch program and can really be just about anything. And that's where you see things like just selling French fries or selling one slice of pizza or selling ice cream. And so for students, it's really a choice for them sometimes between a balanced lunch or just a bunch of a la carte items. And unfortunately, what seems to be happening is a lot of kids just go for the a la carte items and can spend the same amount of money, get something that they think tastes better but is actually far less nutritious.
Mm. And I suppose then in addition to the a la carte choices, there are still questions about other things that the schools may vend. Do they have machines, for example, and are they selling things like soda? Are they selling Doritos? Are they selling Snickers? Are they selling things like that, that where we have real concern that if kids have free access, they're going to be chowing on a lot of stuff that's just really not very good quality food?
That's exactly right. And I think one of the things that has really changed in the last 30 years is the existence of vending machines in schools. And research has shown that particularly in high schools, they're practically everywhere. And what had happened in the 90s is soda companies started having something called pouring rights contracts, where essentially they would have a financial deal with a school district so that they would be allowed to put their vending machines in the school with the idea that they were then an exclusively Coke school or an exclusively Pepsi school, and then they would give the school a cut of the profits. But what ended up happening was the school then became dependent on that money and was really in a double bind in terms of wanting to encourage the students to drink healthy things, but at the same time financially benefiting from them drinking soda.
And this is something that I know that you've done some – you've looked at, because I think that I'm sure that some schools, if you said to them, we think it'd really be a good idea if you took these machines out, they would say, well, I can see your point there, but we may actually make money off of selling these things. We need that revenue. We can't afford to take the vending machines out.
That's exactly right. And so what has ended up happening – is that the places that have been most successful in taking vending machines out of schools are states that have passed a state law. Mm-hmm. So it happens to be that here in Connecticut, a couple of years ago, there was a state law that made it illegal to sell anything but water, juice, and milk in schools. And frankly, that was really the only way to get the soft drink machines out of the schools, because the school district principals and superintendents are very concerned about the finances and have a hard time, sort of fighting against that opposition to taking the machines out.
Is there an option for schools to keep the vending machines and possibly get a little bit of revenue that way, but put in the machines things that are good and maybe have some control over the choices that way.
That is definitely an option, and that is what a lot of school districts have done. So in Connecticut, you can sell, as I said, water, juice, and milk. And so sometimes they will stock vending machines with 100% juice and water, and the students will purchase it. So one of the things that time has sort of told is that if children are thirsty and there's a beverage available, they will purchase it. And if it's water or juice, they'll drink that. If it's soft drinks, they will drink that.
Let me very quickly introduce again our guest, then I have a caller we'll get to. We're talking this morning with Dr. Marlene Schwartz. She's the Deputy Director for the Rudd Center for Food Policy and Obesity at Yale University and has done a lot of research on how the home, how the community, how the school, how all of those things shape eating attitudes and behaviors of children. And she's going to be here visiting the campus of the University of Illinois next week to take part in a conference. And we'll tell you more about that a little bit later on. And questions are welcome here on the show, 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. And here's a caller, someone in Urbana, line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Yes. Would you please also discuss the role of decreasing activity level in our children's lives, especially. I raised two children, one born in the 1970s earlier, and the second born early 1980s. And I noticed a big difference sometime later in the 1980s, the electronic games came along, and suddenly the children on the street and in the yards vanished. And at the same time, the school budgets were getting an axe, and there the sports activity level went down. The supervision in recesses for kids was reduced and things of that nature. And then we hear in the 90s this whole thing about children having weight problems. So I thought maybe you could discuss some of that. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Go ahead.
Sure. Well, the caller raises an excellent point. Certainly, weight is an equation that has to do with calories in and calories out, and physical activity levels are a big concern. As he mentioned, that schools are less likely to offer gym because of concerns about test scores and wanting to have as much academic time as possible. And another, I think, really big societal shift is electronic games, television, computers, and there's a lot of time that children spend in sedentary activities, whereas, you know, 20, 30 years ago, they were more likely to be at least moving around while they played. One of the most striking research findings is the very strong relationship between the number of hours a child watches television and the likelihood that he or she is overweight. And in fact, another really strong predictor is having a television in the child's room. So in terms of practical advice, one of the things that I think parents should be aware of is that it's definitely a good thing to keep TVs out of your child's room, because having them in their room is going to increase the amount of time they spend watching.
Yeah. Just to stay with this question about what it means to have the loss of structured physical activity, as you say, and I think a lot of people will understand, there's so much emphasis now placed on academics that what schools have done is that they've done things like they've cut back on recess, they've cut back on PE. Have there actually been schools that have eliminated physical education, or is it mostly a matter that it's maybe not every day and not as long as it was?
I don't know if there are schools that have entirely eliminated it. That tends to be something that's regulated at the state level. So most states will have a law about how much physical education is required in their schools. But I think that it has decreased significantly, that there are very few places where they will have PE every day. And the amount of time children spend in recess has decreased significantly.
Just to go back to the vending machine question that we were talking about, this concern that if schools have vending machines and if they sell soft drinks and snack foods that are not particularly healthy, you know, that's not a good thing. And some people have said that either we should take the machines out of there or put something better in them. Some people have made this argument. They said, well, you know, if we use that avenue to restrict access to these foods, that then our children, they'll just gorge on them when they do have access. Is there some reason to believe that that's true?
Well, I certainly have heard that argument, and the answer is there's absolutely no reason to believe that's true. It's really an interesting argument, and I think really comes from increased awareness about eating disorders and the role of over-restrictive practices. But what we have done research on this in Connecticut, where we have looked at students in schools that had vending machines with snacks in them, and we've looked at comparison schools where they took those vending machines out, and we looked before and after that happened. And what we found was there was absolutely no change in how much the children ate at home of those foods. So what that really means is it isn't as though children somehow have this internal potato chip monitor that if they don't get their potato chips during the day, they run home and eat twice as many at night. It's much more a case of out of sight, out of mind. If it's not in front of you, you're less likely to eat it, and you don't sort of keep track of it and make up for it later on.
Mm-hmm. And is there some reason to believe that if, let us say, that the school vending machines present a more healthy choice, that then might influence the choices that they make otherwise? That is, if they're there at school, there's the vending machine, it's got juice and it's got milk. Does that make it any more likely that when they're then out in the world and they're looking for something to drink and they are presented with soda or they're presented with juice and milk, that might make it more likely that, in fact, they'll say, oh, maybe I'll have juice or maybe I'll have milk rather than having soda?
That's a really good hypothesis. I don't know that it's been tested specifically, but it certainly makes sense. I mean, the whole reason that Coke and Pepsi wanted their brand in the schools was because they believed that was true, that if you expose children to something early, and especially if it's a branded product, that they're more likely to choose that product later on. So I think by the same token, if you have healthier choices in schools, children have the opportunity to try them. Then if they find that they like them, then they're more likely to eat them later on. And there definitely has been research showing basically people eat what's familiar. So if it's something you're used to seeing and you're used to eating, you're going to be more likely to choose that in the future.
Another caller, Urbana, line one, right here. Hello.
Hello. I'm curious about a remark on your guest made as you were introducing your topic. She talked about the American public buying fast food and said that, if I heard her right, that we have a preference for things that are salty and that are sweet because they taste better. And I'm wondering how much is taste innate and how much is it acquired? For example, if a parent raises a child, giving that child an apple, a slice of apple for an afternoon snack, will that then be something that he learns tastes better, as opposed to giving that child a candy bar or a donut or something like that for an afternoon snack? It seems to me there was an assumption there that I would question.
That's a terrific question, and I'm happy to clarify that. There is research showing that when babies are born, they do have an innate preference for sweetness. And the way they've tested that is by giving newborn babies a choice between sugared water and plain water, and the baby will turn to get the sugared water. There's also evidence that babies quickly develop a preference for salt and fat. So to some degree, there is an innate preference, which from an evolutionary perspective makes sense, because if famine was the biggest problem during most of human history, it would make sense that we're predisposed to prefer foods that are energy dense and will sort of give us the maximum number of calories. Now, with that said, I don't believe that that's destiny and means that, you know, you will always go for the most, you know, the highest sugar or highest fat product. I do think that tastes develop within the context of your culture and your home, and the tastes that you become used to, as I was saying before, become familiar, you will learn to prefer those. So there certainly is a lot that parents can do to try to really acclimate their children to the range of flavors and tastes that they, you know, want to promote in their house. The other thing I would note is there's some very interesting research by a professor named Linda Bartoshuk, who is in Florida, where she's actually found a lot of individual differences in terms of taste. And she's found that some people really have very sort of keen sense of taste and can really, you know, experience taste in a much different way than other people. And so there's also bound to be some individual differences. So people may find they have one child who's perfectly happy there to eat an apple and another child who always is looking for something sweeter.
Thank you very much.
Thanks. I think that also the standard advice that parents are given is that, well, first of all, I think as you've said, people are attracted to things that are familiar. So it maybe is going to be hard for a lot of people to get them to try something that they've never seen before. So I suppose one thing you do is, you know, make sure that you at least have a variety of food in the home, that your children see you eating stuff. It might take them a while to get around to trying it. And in fact, they might have to try it more than once before they'd say, oh, this is okay, give me some more of that. But it needs to be there, and it needs to be familiar. And as long as you try to do that, that's maybe one way to get them a little bit more used to the idea that we eat a lot of different things and, you know, try something, you might like it.
I completely agree with that. And I think that, you know, I have three children of my own. And at one point, I remember wanting to put some salad on each of their plates. And my youngest children were saying, we don't want this. And I said, that's fine. I just want you to get used to seeing it on your plate. So I think this idea that you want to really model what does a healthy meal look like. You certainly want to model eating a range of foods yourself and enjoying healthy foods. And, you know, trust that kids do go through phases. And there are times when they'll be willing to try things, and then they may go through phases where they don't want to try anything. And that some of your children may be more open than other children, but you just need to be consistent, I think, in providing those healthy foods at home and not setting yourself up by having a bunch of unhealthy foods sitting there as well, sort of, you know, distracting the child. I think it's important to have lots of choice, but to have all the choices be good ones.
All right. To some other callers. Champagne next, line number two. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I think I'm on line number one, but
you're on, so go ahead, please.
Okay. My question is, I wonder if we haven't traded one social good for another to some extent. I'm elderly, and my children grew up in the 70s, and they walked to school. Then when they were in the junior high level, the whole issue of integration and busing and so forth came in, and I have noticed that children in the neighborhood seem to have developed bigger paunches, partly because they're bused to school instead of walking. My children walked someplace between three-quarters of a mile and a mile while they were in the elementary grades, and I wonder if anyone has studied that.
That's an outstanding observation, and you're absolutely right. There has been a very substantial decrease in the percentage of children that either walk or bike to school. And there actually is a national organization, I believe it's called Safe Routes to School, and their mission is to really help communities find sort of safer ways for students to get to school using either walking or biking. And I think there are a number of other things. There was the busing for racial integration. There's also a lot of concern about safety. People were worried about children, you know, walking unsupervised and worried about, you know, things like that.
And I hear that from my neighbors.
And then also, I think there's been a change in terms of how communities are physically built, where schools aren't necessarily put right smack in the middle of the residential area where it's easy for students to walk to. Sometimes there's highways and, you know, really difficult places to walk
and
between
no
where people live. Exactly. So
and no bike lanes.
Exactly. So I think that, you know, there certainly is attention to this. And I think, you know, just now departments of transportation are starting to get involved in the obesity issue and realize that transportation does affect how much activity each of us gets. And things like adding sidewalks, you know, requiring new developments to have sidewalks. I think all of those changes are just starting, and I'm hopeful that it will improve in the coming decades.
Do you have a website or two to recommend on that question?
I think if you search for Safe Routes to School, I believe that they do have a website.
Thank you so much.
All right, thanks.
Sure.
It's just interesting this subject came up because here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, this is Walk and Bike to School Day. And it's an organized thing that was sponsored by the Champaign-Urbana Safe Routes to School Project. And what they did, it was they're trying to organize things where we're in both the local school districts today that kids will do that in large groups so that they deal with the safety issue. And I think even some kids who are bused, what they're doing was they took the bus and they stopped it at a particular point and said, okay, now from here, we're going to walk the rest of the way. This is a one-day thing, but perhaps something like that can get people thinking about this a little more, and try and make that happen. But I think for all the reasons that you and the caller cited, it's now much more difficult than it was in the past.
Hmm.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580. Let me reintroduce. Our guest in this hour of the show is Dr. Marlene Schwartz. She's the deputy director for the Rudd Center for Food Policy and Obesity at Yale University. And by the way, they do have a very nice website that has a lot of information on this and other subjects that you might want to take a look at. In her research, she looks at how the home and the community and the school all shape eating attitudes and behaviors of children. She will be here in Champaign-Urbana next week to take part in the Illinois Summit on Early Childhood and Healthy Beginnings. That'll be on Friday, October 16th. This is being hosted by the Family Resiliency Center and the Pampered Chef programs in the Department of Human and Community Development here at U of I. And if you'd like to find out more about this, the easiest way probably is to go to the Family Resiliency Center website. So go to your browser and just put in FRC. So that's Family Resiliency Center, frc.illinois.edu. And you can find out more about this conference, and you can register that way. Also, the kickoff event here for this will be a talk by the president of the University of Illinois. That's Joe White. He'll be talking on Brilliant Futures for America's Children. That's a lecture at 7 o'clock in the evening on Thursday. So that's the night before, Thursday, October 15th. And then the conference takes place the next day. And this is happening at the Alice Campbell Alumni Center on the U of I campus. And here on this show, of course, we're talking particularly here, we're trying to talk a little bit about what schools can do to encourage children to make better choices when it comes to food. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. And let's talk with someone in Champaign in line one. Hello.
Hi. This is a great conversation, particularly topical for me. I just finished a fantastic book called In Defense of Food, and I recommend it to everybody. It's called, the subtitle is An Eater's Manifesto. The author is Michael Pollan, P-O-L-L-A-N. And one of the points that he makes is, and it refers to two callers ago, a lot of the, as he calls it, the industrial food complex, specifically designs food products to tap into our biological imperatives, like seeking out high-fat, high-calorie foods in case of times of famine. Now, that is definitely a biological imperative. And the food companies know this. And if you look at all of the processed foods, they all are laced with this stuff, fats, salt, sugar, because that's what, at a very basic level we crave. So in the school system, I think it's the exact same thing. In defense of food, on the very cover, he really lays out his basic premise. Three key points. Eat food. That is, food that's not processed. For example, if it's got more than five ingredients on the label, it's not really food. If it never decays like a Twinkie, it's not really food. If there's an ingredient on the label that you can't pronounce, it's probably not really food. So that's his first point. His second point is don't eat too much. And his third point is eat more plants. And that's the manifesto right there in very simple terms. And the book really goes ahead and describes how all of this, the food industry knows all this stuff about human beings, and they prey upon it. And that's one of the reasons why obesity has increased so dramatically. It's simply a money-making tool. So that was one thing I wanted to mention. The other thing is I really appreciate the point that you made out of sight, out of mind. If food's not available, that's bad for you, then people won't eat it. And it is the case that people do eat the quick and easy foods both at school and at home. And there's been so much documentation toward this. I mean, there's really no question about it. You go to the office, and if there's donuts at the meeting, people are going to eat donuts. If there's no donuts at the meeting, people won't eat donuts. It's as simple as that. If, you know, there's crummy sitcoms on TV, people are going to watch them because that's what TV offers. If we actually produced good TV, then people would watch that too because that's what TV offers. So I think it's really a fair point to say that people will consume whatever's on the shelf. And if we put good things on the shelf, people will consume that, whatever the area is. If there's bad things on the shelf, people will consume that, whatever the area is. So I really appreciate that point. I think that's important for us to remember. If we force the schools to provide good things on the shelf, kids will eat it because they don't have much of a choice. If we give them the option to eating bad things, well, kids are going to eat it. Why? Because that's what we do. We're human beings. We take what's available, and if what's available tastes great, it doesn't matter if it is not necessarily good for us. If it satisfies our basic needs as animals, as mammals, then we're going to go ahead and eat that. So I just wanted to toss that in there. I really appreciate both those points.
Okay.
Again, that book, In Defense of Food, by Polan, P-O-L-L-A-N, fantastic book for anybody who's interested in, as he calls it, the industrial food complex and how it has made America fat for profit's sake. It's a really interesting read. Thanks.
All right. Thank you. You can comment on that any way that you might like.
Sure. Actually, I'm a huge Michael Pollan fan as well, and I have read that book. And one of my favorite points that he makes is if your grandmother wouldn't recognize it, then it's not food. So I think that really gets to the point that things have changed substantially, and so much more of our food is packaged and processed. And, you know, again, it was done in a way to make our lives easier and to make it more convenient, but I feel like it's gone so far to that extreme that we're now paying with these health consequences. And just to raise another point or sort of reiterate the point about people will eat what's in front of them, I did do a study once where we went into school cafeterias, and what we learned was that, as I mentioned before, the school lunch has those certain components that are required. But in order for a cafeteria to get reimbursed for selling a lunch, the children only have to take 3 of those 5 components. And so what I had seen was that students would take the protein, the starch, and the milk, and they would leave the fruit and vegetable behind. And so we did a little study where we went into one school, and instead of allowing the child to sort of decide whether or not to take the fruit, we had the people working there prompt them to take it and essentially say, would you like a piece of fruit or some juice, with the implication being you're taking one or the other. And then in the other school, we left things the way they were. And what we found was that when the kids were prompted to take that fruit serving, they were just as likely to eat it as the children in the other school who had, quote, voluntarily, you know, sort of decided to take it. So it, again, really emphasizes that children will eat healthy food, but you have to kind of get it in front of them when they're hungry, and then they're more likely to do it. And I use this at home all the time. If I'm making dinner and my children are sort of gathered around, you know, waiting for me to be done, I will cut up a piece of fruit, stick it on the dining room table, and I don't even say anything. I just leave it there. And typically by the time, you know, it's time to sit down, it's already been eaten.
I thought that study was really interesting, and the thing I think that really struck me about it was that no hard sell was required. That, you know, well, they weren't making a big thing out of it. They were just saying, as the kids were coming through the line, the cafeteria worker just said, hey, would you like some fruit? That was all, and that was apparently all it took.
That's right. Yeah, I mean, I think we forget sometimes, especially with children, you know, we live in a country that has such a high value on individualism and freedom and choice that we sometimes forget that children need a little bit of nudging sometimes, you know, to kind of put them in the right direction. And it's really not fair to put all the pressure on them to independently, you know, learn all this nutrition education and manage their choices and, you know, sort of cognitively, you know, make their diet the way it should be. We really need to help them. And so I think that, you know, the idea that we can do this in subtle ways and in environmental ways without, you know, jumping up and down really shows that they can be helped, and in a way that doesn't really put an additional burden on them.
Yeah. You know, recently, and I want to go back to the subject of school lunches. Recently, I heard a very interesting interview with a woman who was in charge of the food service for the St. Paul Public Schools. And she explained that she was talking about their budget and the resources that they have. And she explained that they have less than $3 to spend per student per meal. And that's not just the money that they spend on the food that they serve. It's the entire cost of their operations they have to pay out of that, which means they're paying their workers, they're paying their benefits, they're paying the bills for the lights, presumably, to heat the steam tables, they're paying for trucks, and that some people apparently say that if you really wanted to offer a really good school lunch with lots of fresh fruits and vegetables, locally sourced if possible, some people say it would really take more like $5 per child. Some people say, well, maybe you could do it for four. But it seems like the bottom line is here that schools don't have the money that it takes to really provide good quality food. Do you think that that's true?
I do think that's true. And in my research here in Connecticut, I've gotten to know a lot of the food service directors, and I've heard the exact same thing, that they really are put in a very difficult position of needing to remain sort of cost neutral. They don't really get, you know, they get funding to cover their expenses, but they need to sell enough food and sort of get enough money from the government to do all of that. And, you know, I think if you sort of take a step back, it really says something about priorities and, you know, where our priorities are as a country. And the good news is that the federal law that manages the school lunch is coming up for reauthorization within the next year and hopefully will be able to put more money into the school lunches. But I think another consequence of the industrialization of food and the processing is that in many ways food has gotten less expensive. And we as a country spend a much smaller percentage of our personal income on food than just about any place else on earth. And it was striking when I first heard those statistics because I realized that, you know, we have a really low threshold for what we're willing to spend on food. And I think that we are unique in that. And in other parts of the world, people just expect that you need to spend a greater proportion of your income on food, and they value it in a different way. I think of Alice Waters, who is in Berkeley, California, and has been involved in school food there. And she said, you know, if you are what you eat, here in the United States, we're cheap, fast, and easy. And I thought that really summed it up, that we need to think more about the quality of food and not just getting sort of the most for your money.
And something else I'm interested in your reaction to that also that this woman said, she was talking about the regulations, and I guess these are federal regulations. I don't know. They might be state regulations that talk about the school lunch and what they need to offer. And she kind of said, you know, the problem with the regulations is that they're all about nutrition. And it seems that what she was saying was they don't really talk about what's good food. You know, maybe they talk about calories, they talk about fat, they talk about sugar, they talk about salt. And that maybe she was suggesting there was a different way, there might be a different way to frame this that would make it easier to talk about what constitutes good food, not just good nutrition.
I think that's a really interesting point. And actually, Michael Pollan does address this in the book we were just discussing, that the way the field of nutrition has evolved, it's become very reductionistic. So people study, you know, vitamin D, or people study fiber. And there's a way of, you know, almost turning food into what its chemical properties are rather than appreciating what it is as a whole thing. And so that's how you can end up with, you know, basically, you know, a can of Diet Coke that's been fortified with vitamins and minerals, and they can argue that this is a healthy food. So I do agree that it would be helpful if we were able to move away from that kind of thinking and look more at, you know, sort of whole foods and foods that are, you know, much closer to their natural sources and not just get caught up in the grams of fat or the grams of sugar.
We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Our guest is Dr. Marlene Schwartz. She is the deputy director for the Rudd Center for Food Policy and Obesity at Yale University. And we are talking about healthy food. And particularly here, we've been talking about schools and their role in providing healthy food to students and maybe encouraging them to think about healthy eating. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Again, to stay with the schools, we're talking here about the food that's available in the school. both the official lunch and then other things that are available for students to have if they choose, and then the subject of vending machines. If we, you know, we sort of make this assumption that if we get quality food, if we put it in front of the children, they will take it. Well, I think we know that people know what's good for them, and yet they still don't do it. So that gets to this question of what should we be doing or how are we doing with providing nutrition information to students as part of the instructional program?
Well, I think that, you know, nutrition education is certainly important. One problem I think we have in our country, though, is there in some ways is too much nutrition information, that there are just dozens and dozens and dozens of books out there telling you how to eat, what you should be eating. And I think people, you know, often are looking for quick fixes or, as I said before, looking for like one nutrient, whether it's protein or fat, to really focus on. And I think children are probably confused by that. And at the same time, I think that the, you know, the good advice of things like whole grains, fruits and vegetables, low-fat dairy, you know, people do know it. And I even went into a kindergarten once and asked the children, you know, which is healthier for you, an apple or a cookie? And every kindergartner knew that the apple was healthier than the cookie. But when it came to snack time and we put them out on a tray, guess which they picked? They picked the cookie. And so, you know, I believe knowledge is important, but I actually think the environment is more important because we have a hard time, you know, sort of cognitively managing our diet. It's much easier if we can just, you know, respond to the environment that we're in.
Okay. Let's talk with another caller, someone in the community of Mahomet, not too far away. Line one. Hello.
Yes. I'd like to say two things. I had a friend who worked in the cafeteria out here for 10 years, and she said the food was just crap. That's C-R-A-P. And secondly, if you go to Europe, it's very evident that the food is much more expensive. It's very, very costly. And so you don't eat as much because you can't afford to eat like you can in this country, mainly because they're small countries. They don't have near as much farming, and so they don't have near as much food. So they're very used to paying a lot more for their food, and they don't have that much to spend on food. So that's why they eat less. It's very simple. The French call us dumb, fat, and lazy, and they even have cartoons about us, and they have had for a long time. And so I think we need to get down to the nuts and bolts and quit talking about this so much and just do the right thing. Thank you so much.
Okay. Well, I guess the only my reaction to that is I was very struck the other day when I was listening to a report about the controversy that's now going on in Paris about whether or not they want to put a McDonald's as part of the food choices at the Louvre. And the thing that I heard that really struck me is that next to Americans, the French are the second biggest consumers of McDonald's in the world.
Oh, that's interesting.
So I'm not sure that they're doing all that much better. But anyway, you can respond to the caller however you like.
Well, I mean, I think that the economics of food are extremely important, as she pointed out. And certainly, you know, people do make food decisions based on cost. And if you are in a place where food is more expensive, you are going to eat less. I mean, it's sort of an unpopular political position to say we need to make food more expensive. I don't know that people will go for that. My boss, Kelly Brownell, has been really a big proponent of taxing soft drinks, with the idea being that you'll decrease consumption of sugared soft drinks by adding a tax. And so, you know, it's really an interesting question. We really painted ourselves into a corner in this country with the way our food industry has developed, that, you know, people have gotten used to inexpensive food, and it's going to be hard to change that.
One quick question here, and then I'll get back to the callers, is, and this is something that also people raise. They say, if we spend so much time talking about kids being overweight and make a big thing out of weight and young people, are we going to make worse the problem that we already have with eating disorders among, I guess, particularly among adolescents?
Yeah, that's an extremely interesting question. That's certainly a concern I've heard about a lot. Before I started studying obesity, I actually did clinical work and treated people with anorexia and bulimia and binge eating disorders for about 10 years. So I'm pretty familiar with both sets of problems. And so I have a couple of responses. First is, you know, as awful as eating disorders are, and they're very serious clinical problems, the prevalence of eating disorders is maybe a tenth or a 20th of the prevalence of obesity. So as a public health, you know, problem, it's much, much smaller. But with that said, I think that, you know, you don't want to make particularly adolescent girls feel even worse about their bodies and even more concerned. And so I think if they're done well, I think obesity prevention programs or initiatives really can avoid, you know, triggering eating disorders by focusing very much on the idea that everyone needs to be eating better, that this isn't just about overweight children. You know, so you wouldn't want, for example, to have a family where one child is overweight and they're given different food than the other children in the family. You want to make this more about health and you want to make it about everyone. And I think if that's the case, then you're less likely to trigger sort of individual feelings of shame or feeling badly about their weight.
Let's talk with some other folks here, and we'll go next to our line three, and that's someone right here. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
You've just raised so many interesting points this morning, and I have to agree with just about every one of them. Along the lines of school districts trying to provide healthy lunches for the kids, you know, Alice Waters has been really a pioneer in that area. And there are many school districts, unfortunately not enough, who are trying to accommodate, you know, to having providing better food options for their kids. And I just want to say that one of my daughters is a chef educator, she calls herself. And she has started a farm-to-table lunch program in the school where her daughter goes, elementary school. And once a month, the kids are encouraged to, the rest of it, and most of the time, all the time, they bring their own lunches. But once a month, they are invited to take part in this farm-to-table lunch program, which provides food for all locally produced food, and I'm always surprised when she tells me what the menu has been because sometimes it includes arugula and goat cheese, and it's a very popular program. That's it.
Yeah. Well, great. Dr. Schwartz, any thing you'd want to say about that?
I mean, I just think that those, you know, kind of local initiatives are terrific. And, you know, this is a movement, I think, that people are, you know, really wanting to rethink what is being sold in schools. And I think that, you know, some districts that have, you know, or some communities that have members who sort of have the expertise and the drive to help out like that, I think it's a huge gift to the community.
All right. I want to thank the caller. Try to get one more here. We'll go to line two. This is someone in Urbana. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Hi. I have a question, a specific question, and then just a couple of comments that I'd appreciate any feedback on. And what my question is, you know, I kind of took Diet for a Small Planet as my Bible as a young adult. And I'm wondering, I mean, I'm stubborn. And has there been any advance on nutritional information, really, since that book in the 70s, which basically said growing humans, children, need more protein than adults, and we should eat more plant foods? I guess, you know what, that's my question.
Yeah, we have to take that, and because we're really short on time, I want to thank you for the question and say, well, Dr. Schwartz, you want to comment on that?
Well, I have to admit I haven't read that book, so I can't really speak to that. But in terms of the idea of, you know, sort of eating more plant food and, you know, kind of keeping things simple. I don't know that we've made that much more progress. I think in some ways we've come full circle. I think that, you know, we've gotten very sort of hyper-scientific in looking at food and breaking it down into, as I said before, sort of chemicals and nutrients, and forgotten, you know, the idea of food as a whole thing that comes from nature. And so I think in some ways it may be that we're coming back around to that idea.
We're going to have to come to a close here because we're here at the end of the show. What I wanted to mention again, though, for folks who are really interested in these issues, one place that you could go would be to the website of the Rudd Center for Food Policy and Obesity at Yale. Our guest, Dr. Marlene Schwartz, she's the deputy director of the center. There's a lot of good information there generally about the problems that we've been talking about and how we might address them. So that's one way to go. For people who are in and around Champaign-Urbana, our guest will be giving the keynote speech for the Illinois Summit on Early Childhood and Healthy Beginnings. This is taking place on the U of I campus at the Campbell Alumni Center. That's in Urbana on South Lincoln. Next week, Friday, and it's a one-day event. And this is being hosted by the Family Resiliency Center within the Department of Human and Community Development at the U of I. And if you go to their website, which is frc.illinois.edu, you can find out more about it. It kicks off with a talk by the president of the university, Joe White, talking on brilliant futures for America's children. This will be at 7 o'clock next Thursday night, so you can take part of that. And this certainly, these issues are kind of things that we're really interested in. We try to promote some thinking about and discussion of, we've done on the show. And in fact, our CU Fit Families group is actually working with the Family Resiliency Center to try to address specifically the problem of childhood obesity here in Champaign-Urbana. So it's something we're thinking about and talking about and trying to get people talking about, and I'm sure we'll be doing that again in the future. But certainly for now, we want to say to our guest, Marlene Schwartz, Dr. Schwartz, thank you very much for spending some time with us today.
Thank you for having me on the show. It's been great.
Also, we want to say thanks to Phil Kearney. He's the engineer at Yale on the other end of our connection. Thanks for making things happen here this morning. This program, Focus 580, is supported in part by Bodywork Associates, offering professional licensed massage therapy to Champaign-Urbana since 1982, now with four area locations, including inside the new Activities and Recreation Center north of Memorial Stadium on the U of I campus. More information is at bodyworkassociates.com. Support also comes from Warden Martin Subaru in Savoy. At Subaru's assembly plant in Lafayette, Indiana, a zero landfill status is designed to save cost and our future environment. It's part of what makes a Subaru a Subaru. Information online at wardenmartin.com or 352-8910. That's it for us here on Focus, but we want you to stay tuned. There's more coming up as part of the Afternoon Magazine. Celeste Quinn is the host, and I think in your 1 o'clock, you'll really be carrying on the kind of the same theme that we've been going on here this morning.
Exactly. We will talk with Tara Brockman this afternoon following the 1 o'clock news. She's a writer. She's also a member of a five-generation Illinois farming family, and she's the author of the book The Seasons on Henry's Farm, A Year of Food and Life on a Sustainable Farm. Henry is her brother, Henry Brockman. Tara Brockman will be our guest this afternoon following the 1 o'clock news. Let's turn our attention now to commodity prices. In Kansas City, December wheat is trading at $4.79. That's up 3.5. March, $4.95, up 4. In Chicago, December wheat, $4.61.25, up 1. March, $4.80.75, up 1.5. December corn, $3.58.25, unchanged. March, $3.70.25, down 1/4. May, $3.79.25, up 1/2. July, $3.86.25, unchanged. November soybeans, $9.09.25, down 3/4. January, $9.13.75, down 1/2.